Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast, and welcome to the Diversity and Inclusion Day with an American Fisheries Society virtual annual meeting. Fish are amazing creatures with a diverse set of colors, shapes, and sizes. They truly are a diverse group of animals, and so are humans. This podcast is more about people than fish, which is also the case. Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast, and welcome to the Diversity and Inclusion Day with an American Fisheries Society virtual annual meeting. Fish are amazing creatures with a diverse set of colors, shapes, and sizes. They truly are a diverse group of animals, and so are humans. This podcast is more about people than fish, which is also the case in fisheries, believe it or not. Any fisheries manager will tell you, it's about working with people. The fish are the easy part. Here, we focus on people and on extremely important topics, including the benefits of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the field of fisheries and aquatic sciences. Some topics may be uncomfortable at times, but this will be a safe zone from which everyone can learn. Although this is an initiative led by Clemson University students and supported by the American Fisheries Society, it applies to everywhere and to everyone, and it transcends fisheries. We strive for everyone to feel involved and included, no matter your country of origin, age, ethnicity, gender, religion, sexuality, and/or disability. Hosts and guests are sharing their personal views, which they hold as their own. We're so glad you've chosen to join us today. We appreciate you as part of this session and part of this virtual annual meeting coming and learning. Thanks for joining us. And I'd like to introduce Dion Kerr, the co-host of this podcast.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone. As we begin to start this journey, Aaron and I would like to invite all of you to come prepared with an open mind, ready to think critically. I'd like to follow up with that statement by saying, generally, humans struggle between what is right and wrong. Our personal morals and ethics are shaped by cultural norms and the ones that surround us, including our family, friends, classmates, and colleagues. Our podcast would like to critique your philosophy by challenging some of your personal beliefs regarding right and wrong. We want you to ask yourself, is the way I'm viewing this situation or issue correct, or is it wrong? What is it that I'm not seeing? These are great questions to start with, and it is very important to answer them honestly. Try not to find an answer based on what benefits you, but what's centered around the truth of the matter. Today, we're shaking things up. You're going to be seeing a pre-recorded Zoom chat featuring Ernest Muhammad and all of our beautiful faces today.
Yeah, and so this is new to us. We're trying to deal with all this technology. We've put together, this is our fourth podcast, but we've never done one in a pre-recorded video session. So this is new to us. So bear with us. But Ernie comes to us from Charleston, South Carolina, where he works as a fisheries biologist for the South Carolina DNR. But he also serves as executive director of the Low Country Alliance for Model Communities. Welcome, Ernie.
Thank you for having me.
So without further ado, I'm very eager to hear about everything you have to say today, Ernie. So we'll start off pretty general. Would you mind telling us about yourself and your journey in fisheries?
Yeah. So I grew up in Augusta, Georgia. It was my hometown where I went to school, both high school and college. I went to, I attended Augusta State University. Received my bachelor's degree in biology there. And that is, that experience was my intro to fishery science. You know, growing up and, you know, as an African-American, I was not exposed to career paths. If you had an interest in science, right? I had teachers in high school that would direct you towards certain careers that they felt like if you had an interest in science, you should pursue. So that was either, I mean, it was either education, becoming a teacher, a science teacher, or a engineer, or a chemist, or they told you to become a doctor, right? So those were the career choices that were presented to me when I was interested in science. But I always had an affinity for nature. I spent a lot of my summers as a young boy in the nearby swamps that my neighborhood was surrounded by, just collecting frogs and just different types of, you know, animals that were in the swamp that was near, you know, near my neighborhood. And in the neighborhood children too. I mean, we did some crazy things. We would go and find, you know, alligator nests and mess with, you know, the baby alligators. And these were dangerous things. But, you know, yeah, a child, you know, children don't really see that as dangerous. It's adventurous to them. So I always had that affinity for nature. And when I entered Augusta State University studying biology, it was my zoology professor, Dr. Bruce Saul, at Augusta State University. He invited me to a project that he was doing every summer. Well, really, almost every quarter, he would take students to Cumberland Island off the coast of Georgia, and spent a weekend there doing some assessments of fishery diversity along the Cumberland Island, kind of area. And that was really my first experience of being exposed to fishery, right? And it opened my eyes to a different possibility of a different career. So I came back that following Monday after that trip, I came back and changed my major from pre-med to field biology. And that was my introduction to, you know, fishery science. And I say this all the time, that has been my downfall ever since, getting into fishery biology, right? But we don't get into this field because we pursue the money, or we pursue, you know, because this ain't, you know, if you're looking for a career where you can make a whole lot of money, fisheries is not it.
Not it.
So yeah. You have to love it. Yeah. You have to, you know, have an affinity for doing this work, and that is what attracted me to this, or the overall benefit that we can have, not only to our environment, but just the pursuit of the unknown, in nature, and involved just interacting with nature every day is really one of the benefits.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear. I know as I've taken my first real tech job, right just after, so I graduated back in the springtime, and I accepted a tech position. So now I'm helping out with the Ohio Division of Wildlife now. And it's definitely the biggest feature is just always interacting with nature. Yes. All the time. And you usually, they say, don't ever make your hobbies a job. So, you know, I always love fishing in general. And obviously fishing isn't the same as doing biology and stuff, but you just don't get tired of always working with fish, it seems. So
I agree.
Yeah. I have to agree with what you're saying there.
So Ernie, that's some awesome background on what you shared there, but also, have you faced any personal challenges along the way?
Yeah, I mean, you do. Like I say, in this field, right, a fishery, really in all the fields of STEMs, when you're looking at science, technology, engineering, mm-hmm. mathematics, you do not have a great a number of many, let's say, minority individuals that go into this field, right? Mm-hmm. And that goes back to, our parents' belief, structures within communities, structures within schools that do not promote that these are career paths, right? For students that have an affinity for math and for science, right? Usually in a lot of the urban schools, they become disinterested in the sciences in middle school.
Yeah.
Right, they have a affinity for these things in elementary, but once they hit sixth grade, they lose it.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so there's something that is happening there with our minority children, that they are not having this feeling that these are career paths for them, right? And I don't know if it's how the material is presented to them. I just don't know. We just have to figure that out. Or how do we get more minority children at the middle school level and high school level to continue that interest out of elementary school into the sciences, right? Yeah. So that is one challenge that I experienced. The second challenge is that when you do have a minority individual that continue to pursue this into undergrad or into graduate school, what happens is a lot of times they are the only one in that particular subject that is being taken, and you have this feeling that no one else in this room or in this space or at this meeting or at this conference looks like me, right? I go to many fishery conferences, and I am the only African American, the only minority, really, that is in the room. And you just don't know the feeling that that comes with that. I mean, it's a burden to walk away from that experience knowing that we could do more, you know, as a field to get more minorities interested in sciences, even at the undergraduate level, at high school level, and even the graduate level, right? I mean, we just have to do our agencies. When I'm talking about agencies, I'm talking about the federal level and state level. We need to put specific initiatives, right, that target minority individuals to attract them to the sciences, fisheries, in this case, it's fishery science, right? So attracting them to this type of work. And we cannot get trapped into this idea that because we are specifically targeting minority individuals to this field, that somehow we are practicing discriminatory towards other groups. That we should not take that position. I have, you know, I have heard that said before, that minority programs in agencies or at universities or school, you know, schools to attract minorities to this field is discriminatory. It is not discriminatory because they are not representative. If you look at minority populations in certain states, they have a high percentage in those states, but they are less represented in the, you know, the careers when you look at their population numbers in a state. So we need to look at that, you know, those strategies and really rethink about how do we attract minority individuals into this field and not feel that what we're doing is discriminatory in any way.
Man, that's powerful. I know some of the things kind of going into just that interest in science dropping off. I know for myself, I feel kind of similar to you where growing up, it wasn't with extreme animals like alligators, but I would find myself always trying to find bird nests or I don't know why nesting is so interesting in general, but I would always try to find things like that or lift up rocks to see what's under them. Toads and frogs for sure. And you just wanted to mess with them, but as well as like the little wildlife documentaries or so that we all get to see when we're little kids coming up. And, you know, there's definitely no denying it. Like all of us loved watching those things and just experiencing that type of career field. I mean, we don't really think of it that way when we're young, but we all enjoyed it. But then, when we get older, it does seem like it drops off. And I think one of my struggles, it wasn't until at least the undergrad level was I felt like I was incapable of maybe completing the demands, so like doing the math, I guess. And that's one thing I hear a lot just from my own peers that are African Americans is, you know, they're like, wow, you're in science, I couldn't do that math, or I couldn't write. And I think, you know, and they need someone to just tell them, hey, it's really not that hard.
young children, right? They're like sponges. They can soak this stuff up. And if we encourage them at a young age and give them different options of careers, right? And not just say, because you're good in math, you only need to look at, this particular field, but expose them, right? It's an exposure. Yeah. And it is one of the reasons why the community-based organization that I also work in, that we have a focus on youth, right? So we focus on younger youth, not necessarily high school youth, because we feel that a child in high school kind of already have their mind made up. And it's difficult to kind of get them to switch they do not want to go into the sciences. It's difficult, we have found. But if you can catch them at middle school, elementary and middle school, right, as they're transitioning into middle school, and keep them interested in science, they are highly likely to pursue something in the STEMs career, right? Yes. And we understand that not every child is going to want to go to college. Mm-hmm. That, and we should not push every child towards college, right? Yeah, yeah. But there are opportunities too in the STEMs in technical trades, right? That can be pursued in the on the technical side, like some technician type career paths and things like that are uniquely connected to the sciences. So we need to identify whatever those passions are that our children have, and expose them broadly to where those passions can lead them, right? For example, a child may decide that they love science, but they love writing. Mm-hmm. So they can be a journalist that covers science. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's different ways. So we just have to think differently about how we encourage the passions that our children have.
Yeah. Yeah. Aaron, is there anything on your mind?
No, I think, he started talking about his Low Country Alliance for Model Communities. And I think it'd be awesome to hear more about that organization.
Yeah. So Low Country Alliance for Model Communities is a nonprofit organization in the city of North Charleston. It was really formed by the residents of those areas that we represent today. They wanted an organization because they were frustrated with prior processes that did not work for them, did not address their immediate needs. So they developed their own organization to address their needs, and primarily around quality of life concerns. So when you're talking about affordable housing, economic development, education, and then primarily environmental justice. So the disproportionate impacts that these communities have when it comes to air pollution and land pollution and water pollution, right? The contaminants in our water. They wanted to address those unique kind of situations that are legacy, right? These are legacy pollution. So this did not happen overnight. It happened because of land use decisions in communities and why these particular activities exist in marginalized communities, minority communities particularly. Our organization was formed to address those needs and find solutions, right? So on the environmental justice front, right? So we have a youth component, we have a citizen science component, and we have an education component to our environmental justice work. And our education component is primarily around educating those local decision makers, right? So our politicians, those ones that come up with policy around why environmental justice is important and why it needs to be addressed. Our focus on our youth is primarily to get them interested in the STEMs and public health science. So not only the science and tech, now, you know, the science that we think about, right? Biology, chemistry, physics, you know, those earth science, you know, those kind of things, but also public health as a science. And I think COVID-19 has really exposed a myriad of reasons of why we need more minority participation when it comes to public health, right? And the disproportionate impact that comes when a lot of the issues and concerns in minority communities when it comes to health disparities and the lack of access to healthcare and the lack of access to primary healthcare are issues and burdens that many minority communities carry, and why their participation in these fields matter, and why it will improve the way that these sciences move forward.
Absolutely.
Following along with that, Ernie, could you kind of take us through a daily interaction with the Low Country Alliance? Like, what I'm just curious, like, what's it like? Because I don't know, I'm a visual learner, so yeah, I'm kind of just interested in the things the organization does on a daily perspective.
Yeah. So on a daily perspective, we have four core areas that we focus on: affordable housing, economic development, education, and then environmental justice, right? And we pursue strategies, holistic strategies that will address these core concerns to improve the quality of life of the residents that we represent. So our strategies are intentional and they are transformative. Right. So whatever activities that we do, we just don't do transactional activities. We are purposefully intentional about our work to ensure that it's transformative. We have a theory of change that our work is grounded in. And that theory of change is that we meaningfully engage our communities in meaningful ways. Mm-hmm. So meaningfully engaging means that our communities are brought in on projects to help not only inform those projects, but they help to design them, they help to implement, and they help to evaluate, right? So it's important that their participation is involved throughout that whole process. So we meaningfully engage them so that we educate them. Right. So we educate them so that they become the advocates for the change that they want to see. Right. Yeah. Our motto as an organization is that we do not want to be doing this work 25 years from now. We should be working ourselves out of the nonprofit business work. Right. So that means that we have to set up strategies, processes, programs that empower communities. Right, empower the residents to become the solutions to the concerns that they have in their communities. So that means helping with policy at the local level, in the state level, in the regional level, to design strategies that will address communities' core areas. Working with local decision makers about their impacts of decisions on communities and how those. A decision process can change to involve more communities in that so that their process is more informed. Because we see that in order to address a problem, right, you have to have the people who are that's dealing with those problems at the table to design the solution. Otherwise, we're going to be running around circle, digging our wheels in the mud. Yeah. Because we're not really coming up with solutions that address the core concerns in communities.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point of view. Like, letting the people that are involved in the issue make a lot of the decisions
is correct.
And background info on how things could change.
Yep. So that is our day-to-day work. And it is rewarding work. And it can be, at times, it can be discouraging, right? Mm-hmm. Because you do run into people who have, preconceived ideas about communities, preconceived ideas about certain individuals that are trapped in what we call cycles of poverty. And these are generational concerns, right? And we feel that all these issues around environment, not only environment, but how our communities are designed and built and the ability to access education, right? Not only when you're talking about formative years, but you're talking about adult-based education as well, GED programs, technical schools, you know. So being able to break down those barriers that prevent people from improving their quality of life and the opportunities to improve their quality of life. That is the work that our organization does.
Yeah,
that's awesome. And I hear your excitement when you talk about STEM fields and fisheries and your youth education program. Could you explain a little bit more about that youth education program and what you do?
Yeah. So our youth program is based on elementary and middle school students. And we work with the community recreational centers in the communities that, so we work in seven communities. And four of those communities have recreation centers, or you know, community centers. And we, every summer, we engage those children through their summer camp activities. So we have devised a week-long STEMS program that is, you know, we introduce STEMS to those students on a, you know, throughout that week. And it's various topics. One could be on sales. So one activity we did with students, which the children really loved, is that we walked them through an activity to learn about the basic development of sales, the basic life structure. And it was an edible sale. So at the end of it, they only not only learned about the components that make up, you know, our cellular structure, mm-hmm. but at the end, they got to eat it. So it started with a graham cracker, you know, kind of icing and candies that, you know, they learned about the cell wall and the nucleus and, you know, everything that makes up, you know, you know, and at their level. And at the end of it, they got to eat it. So, you know, so that was really fun for them. Mm-hmm. Another fun activity that they love for us to do, right? So we have three of them that they love for us to do. The sale one is one that they love. Bringing in live animals, right? So we bring in marine life for them to touch and talk about and ask questions. And then the third one that they really love for us to do is the introduction to fishing. So our communities are sandwiched between two creeks, Ashley River and Cooper River. And they do not get an opportunity because of the challenges in low wealth communities, right? Of access to, you know, public transportation only take them so far. So they can't get to the riverside, right? There's barriers to the, you know, their access to the river. So we teach them beginning skills for fishing. So how to cast your line, how to bait your line, how to, you know, string your fishing pole, you know, how to take the fish off of your fishing pole. So we do the 101 basics of casting and introducing them to fishing. Then we take them. So this is an all day event that we do. It usually happens on a Saturday. Then we take them to a local fishing spot and they actually get to fish. So we wrote a grant and received a grant to buy fishing poles and tackle. So these children do not have to worry about equipment, access to equipment. We have the equipment. If any of them are interested in fishing, we will loan the equipment out to them for them to go, them and their families to go fishing. So usually every year we do host a family fishing clinic that teach the families about fishing, 101 fishing, and then we have a program, a tackle program, where, you know, we loan out the tackle and the fishing poles for them. Now I can say that, you know, SEDNR has a similar program, but again, there are barriers to that. When you cannot bring those equipment down to the community level, right? They're not going to go way out to James Island. They're not going to go way out, you know, to other places if they don't have access to transportation. So we have to, as an agency, right, make our programs, our initiatives, our public services available to communities that we know are experiencing barriers to these types of programs, right? So we have to remove those barriers.
Yeah.
When you're talking about COVID and our retreat to our homes and being able to use technology to be able to connect, right? When you're talking about disenfranchised communities or marginalized communities, a lot of them do not have access to internet. They do not have access to the technology to allow them to continue to have those connections, right? Like you and I are talking right now. So that produces a different type of burden on marginalized communities. They're disconnected now from those connections that they had in the past. When everything moved online, it created a different type of mental kind of a burden that people are carrying, particularly for our elderly. Because they have time, they want to give back, and they really want to get into, you know, those personal interactions. And because now we can't have those, or those are limited, in frequency, it does create these isolation, you know, these feelings of being isolated from things. Mm-hmm. So, how can we, you know, as professionals, bridge those divides, you know, those technical divides, those are things, and it's going to be a continuing challenge, not only for urban core that faces, you know, that are low wealth, but also our rural communities face these challenges as well.
Yeah, those definitely have to be challenges. I mean, and in general, as society is continuously moving forward, you know, everything's becoming more dependent on technology and internet access. So, that's gotta be a struggle.
Yeah. But I mean, there's ways of getting around that, right? I mean, if we are, public service agencies, and we have, you know, outdoor recreational facilities or landings that we are, you know, as an agency responsible for, what prevents us from putting Wi-Fi in those areas that people then can have access to? Yeah. So, I mean, it's just different ways that we have to think differently about how can state agencies, federal agencies play a greater role in providing these service gaps when it comes to those type of infrastructure needs in the areas that we're responsible for. So, right. Wildlife habitat, areas, boat landings, those type of facilities that we have some control over. Can we put internet access there? Can we host events there to get, more diverse populations to participate? Think about our education programs differently and our initiatives within our organization when it comes to programs, public programs. How can we make them appeal, right, to a diverse population in our states?
Okay, so you also initiated some scientific research that links anglers in your area to contaminant loads. Could you just tell us about that study, Ernie?
So we did a study with NOAA, as well as the Medical University of South Carolina, looking at disproportionate impacts of heavy metal concentration within fish, right? And NOAA at the time was doing some research around dolphin, sentinel species, basically looking at those dolphins as a indicator species for heavy metal pollution and other types of pollution as well in our habitats. And what they found, which we all realize, is that dolphins eat the same type of fish that humans eat, right? So we wanted to see look at those same fish, so spots, whiting, croaker, those types of fish, and look at them where humans tend to fish. And Gullah Geechee communities are subsistence fishing communities, so they do not practice catch and release. So what they catch, they eat. And there was a researcher at the Medical University of South Carolina who did her PhD dissertation on the Gullah Geechee fishing practices and sustainability around that subsistence fishing practices in the Gullah Geechee communities. And when she became a researcher at the University of the Medical University of South Carolina, she wanted to broaden that into our community. So she reached out to our organization. We happily partnered with them, and we looked at some some known fishing spots in our communities using the Ashley River and the Cooper River. And what we were looking, we collected the fish, you know, that fishermen would catch. And also we would ask if we could pull, you know, sample their half article. This was the thing. And I mean, it really reinforced for us that our residents were subsistence fishing people. We thought initially when we were designing the project, we thought we were going to have a hard time getting them to consent to the hair follicle and get more consent with collecting the fish. Actually, when we went out in the field, it was easy for us to get the hair follicle, but more difficult to get the fish.
They wanted to keep the fish to eat.
Yeah, they wasn't willing to give up the fish. They were eating that for dinner, for, you know, for their meal. Mm-hmm. And they were willing to have you dig around in their hair, you know, round in their head, because you're in their personal space to get hair follicle.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, that really interesting. So yeah, that really enforced for us that, yes, these are subsistence fishing communities, and they are eating what they are catching out of the waters, regardless of, you know, toad fish, oyster fish, you know, these things that we tend to catch and then we throw them back because these, you know, we see them as, you know, throwaway fish. But for people who are depending on those fish for food, they're keeping them. They are eating them, right? So we did the study and we published the study. The study is published, University of South Carolina, NOAA and the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources with the help of our organization.
Oh, that's great. Tell us more about the Gullah Geechee community. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, so the Gullah Geechee community runs all the way from North Carolina to the Florida coast.
Okay.
And it has its roots in African culture.
Okay.
When Africans were brought to the shores of Charleston, right? They maintained a lot of that language. The Gullah Geechee community has this unique language. If you ever come to Charleston, right, you hear this dialect, and everyone say, "This is what is this dialect?" It's the Gullah Geechee dialect. It is a unique, language, and it's embedded in the culture. You know, the communities here. Recently, maybe 3 years ago, the local school system realized that a lot of teachers could not understand the children because they were talking this language. Mm-hmm. So what they did was they had a program to immerse their teachers in this language so they could understand the students.
Okay. Oh, that's
the students are coming there with a specific language.
Uh-huh.
And they're saying something that they're familiar with, but the teacher is not.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're starting to realize that this community has a unique language, it has a unique culture, and we cannot, as institutions, ignore that, right? How can we integrate their uniqueness into what we do or how we provide services to them, right? So I can kudo the Charleston County School District for recognizing that they needed to immerse or at least try to understand the Gullah Geechee culture. But the Gullah Geechee culture is a fascinating culture, very unique food dishes. So if you ever come to Charleston, please try to seek out tours around the Gullah Geechee, community. There's many tours here. Some of the food is representative of the Gullah Geechee community, and the language, and just the art, and the grass baskets, sweet grass baskets and things like that, right? And that is becoming, the material that is used to make the sweet grass baskets is becoming endangered because of development of our salt marsh, where that particular grass grows. And because we're having impact on our salt marshes, that source material is being impacted as well.
That's amazing how interconnected everything is, really. Yep. The Gullah Geechee community sounds fascinating to me. I can't wait till this pandemic is over. I'm going to head straight over there with my family and immerse my two daughters and my wife in that. And we're really going to have some fun. I can't wait for that.
I agree.
Is there anything else you'd like to cover today, Ernie, that we haven't talked about yet?
I really enjoyed this conversation. And I really thank you all for having the courage, right? Because it takes courage to encourage these types of conversations, and more of them need to happen. Particularly looking at how our agencies may discourage participation from minority groups, mm-hmm. right? With our education outreach, with our community initiatives, right? Because we have to recognize that the people that work within our agencies, and all of us are guilty of this. We come with our biases, right? Yeah. We come with biases. So when we're designing programs, when we're designing initiatives, when we are designing outreach programs, right? If we don't acknowledge that our biases are also shaping that, then we're doing a disservice to our agencies and to the mission that our agencies say that we are trying to adhere to. Mm-hmm. So we really need to, within our organizations, you know, our state organizations, federal organizations, we need to look at the biases, not only of the people in the organizations, but the culture of the organization, and really take assessment to see if we are discouraging participation from groups that do not look like we look like, right? So we need to have those hard conversations within our organizations, our agencies around that.
Mm-hmm. And that's really what this podcast is all about. That's really what AFS has latched on to with this Diversity and Inclusion Day, and also everything that the Equal Opportunities section has done throughout the years for AFS. And I really think change is coming, and coming for the better. And we truly appreciate this grassroots effort. I mean, this is truly a grassroots community-based effort that's making a true difference in your local community. We can talk about all this grandiose stuff happening nationally or whatever. You're doing it at a grassroots level in your local community. We really appreciate your approach. We hope others truly listen to what you have discussed and will use that to model their own potential organizations and involvement like you have. So we appreciate the time and energy you've spent with us today and making your community a better place. It says a lot about you as a person.
I was gonna add, one other quick thing. I know, just after talking with you, I just want to do more as my own, like, personally talking to my own peers, especially like my minority friends, in trying to interest them in the sciences more. So I think that's something that I would like to pursue more. And that's just alone from talking with you.
Yeah, do it. I mean, it always starts with a conversation, right? And you never know where a conversation goes. Mm-hmm. Even if you see a young man in the neighborhood that has a fishing pole, right? I mean, you just stop and just have a conversation. You never know where that will lead and where that will take, that conversation will take that young man or that young lady. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, we all have a role and responsibility to play in our communities, and wherever our passion lies, that is where we should pursue. And it all starts with a conversation. Mm-hmm.